Chapter 9. Sally stopped jogging as she reached the road where the house was. People noticed runners, and she didn't want to draw attention to herself. She pulled the hood of the parka off her head and looked around. The pavement was deserted. Both sides of the road were lined with cars, but they all appeared to be empty, and there was no sign of a black outlander. She walked along to the house. It was a neat semi-detached with a garage. There was a burglar alarm box high up by the bedroom window. She carried on walking, wanting to make absolutely sure that she wasn't being followed. There was an open reach van parked ahead of her, and she slowed to give it a closer look. Both MI5 and the police used open reach vans for surveillance purposes, because there were so many of them, and people were used to seeing them parked for long periods. Sally figured if the authorities used them, there was every chance that the bad guys did too. But there was no one in the front seats, and there were no signs of cameras. She doubled back. There was a woman with a pushchair talking into a mobile coming towards her. The woman was so engrossed in her conversation that she didn't even glance at Sally as she went by. Sally took a final look around and headed down the driveway, taking her keys from her bag. Each key had a label, colour-coded with red tags for front doors and black tags for back doors, along with a reference number rather than the address. She had memorised all the reference numbers and used the front door key to let herself in. She closed the door behind her and stood with her back to it, listening as she took slow, deep breaths to calm herself down. The house had been her responsibility for the last 3 months. Before that, it was looked after by an arts graduate who had only spent 5 months in the house. His name was Ali Habib. He was tall and good-looking, and by virtue of his Egyptian-born parents and British public school education, he was fluent in Arabic and English, which had got him fast-tracked to Tem's house. The house had only been used twice since Sally had taken it over, and both times she had helped the dressers. When the premises were used, they had to be fitted out to match the personality of the legend that was supposed to be living there. The first time, the legend was that of a GCHQ analyst who was planning to offer sensitive intelligence to a Russian Foreign Intelligence Service agent who operated out of Russia's embassy in Kensington Palace Gardens. They had initially corresponded through emails, but when the Russian agent had requested a meeting, the MI5 officer had asked that he came to the Kingston-upon-Thames house late at night. The dresser, a gay man in his late 50s who had once worked for the National Theatre, brought in computers, books and toiletries and stocked the kitchen cupboards and fridge with food that would be appropriate for a single man in his early 40s. There had been framed family photographs of the man in university robes and others with his family. All had been fabricated by the document experts at Tem's house. The second time had been 2 weeks earlier, when the house was kitted out to fit in with a legend of an MI5 officer posing as a former banker turned money launderer. The officer was involved in the long-term penetration of a group of Belfast-born criminals with links to the new IRA. Two members of the gang were flying over to London for a meeting, and the house needed to be set up just in case they decided to make a spot check on the banker's home address. Out went books on computing, vegetarianism and socialism, to be replaced by books on economics and finance and dozens of best-selling thrillers. The banker's fridge was stocked with champagne and foie gras, silk sheets put on his bed, and one of the bedrooms was converted into a home gym stocked with expensive German exercise machines. The house was equipped with state-of-the-art cameras and microphones. Though Sally was pretty sure they were only active when the house was being used, she headed to the kitchen and opened the fridge. It was empty. The dressers had moved everything out once the Belfast criminals were on the plane home. She found a jar of Nescafe and a bag of sugar, so she filled the kettle at the sink. As she switched on the kettle, her watch buzzed to let her know she had a call. It was Louise Chadwick. Sally frowned as she stared at the screen. She let it ring for several seconds before answering, wondering what on earth she could say. When she took the call, she tried to sound as cheerful as she could, but Louise cut her short. "What the fuck's going on, Sally?" "What do you mean?" Louise was a year younger than Sally and had only joined MI5 3 months earlier, just after Ali moved out. She was in no position to be swearing at Sally. "I've been summoned to Tem's house and no one will tell me what's going on. I phoned Drew and Mo and Afifa and Fiona and no one's answering. I've left messages and they won't call me back. Am I being let go, Sally? Is that it? Are they sacking me?"
"It's not that," said Sally quietly.
"Please don't lie to me," said Louise. "I thought we were friends."
Sally smiled tightly. She had never considered Louise a friend. Louise worked on the ground floor of the Wimbledon house, and in the 12 weeks she'd been there, she'd done nothing more than nod and say good morning. She was ultra-competitive and only had time for those who could help her career. But she deserved to know the truth. "Louise, the house was attacked this morning."
"Attacked? What do you mean attacked?"
"Men with guns went in and killed everybody who was there. Drew, Mo, Fifa, Fiona, David, Tony and Jane. They're all dead." There was silence on the line, and for a moment, Sally wondered if she had lost her connection.
"Louise? Dead?"
"Yes, I'm so sorry."
"Who? Why?"
"We don't know, Louise. It only happened this morning.
Someone just burst in and started shooting."
"They're not sure. There weren't any witnesses that I know about."
"I don't believe this," said Louise.
"I'm having trouble processing it myself," said Sally. "But that's why they want you in."
"Are you in Tem's house?"
"I'm on my way."
"You were working today, right?"
"I was out on a coffee run when it happened. Look, I have to go. I'm so sorry that I'm the one to break the bad news."
"And what's going to happen? Will they shut down the house?"
"You're asking the wrong person, Louise. I'm as much in the dark as you are at the moment. Sorry. I've got to go. Bye." She ended the call and took a deep breath. The thought that it might have been better not to have taken the call sprang to mind. Clearly, whoever had called Louise into Tem's house hadn't told her what had happened, and they presumably had a reason for that. The kettle boiled, and she made coffee in a bright yellow mug. She took her coffee upstairs and into the front bedroom. From the window, she could look down on the street below. She took a sip and winced. She wasn't a fan of black coffee, but she needed the caffeine. She looked at her watch. It was only 11:15. It had been just over 2 hours since she had walked into the house and found the carnage there, but it felt like a lifetime ago. She took another sip of her coffee, then froze as she saw the black Mitsubishi turn into the road. "No fucking way," she muttered to herself as she stared at the vehicle in disbelief. So far as she knew, MI5 didn't use black Mitsubishis, and even if they did, it was unlikely in the extreme that Hadley would send one to collect her after what she had told him. She backed away from the window. A second black Outlander had appeared. The first one was pulling up outside the house. Her heart began to pound. How had they tracked her down? How the fuck did they know where she was? She put the mug on the dressing table and ran downstairs. There was no way she could leave by the front door, so she hurried down the hallway and into the kitchen. If they got into the house, they'd know that she had been there. And there was nothing she could do about that. She pulled at the door handle and cursed when she realized it was bolted. There were two bolts at the top and the bottom. She stood on tiptoe to pull back the top one and then bent down to deal with the lower one. She grabbed at the handle and pulled. It was still locked. She needed a key. She took out her key rings, but there was only the one key to the front door. She looked around frantically. Where the fuck could it be? She pulled open the kitchen drawer nearest to her and sighed with relief when she saw a steel key lying on a folded tea towel. She grabbed it, slammed the drawer shut, and shoved the key into the lock. It turned, and she pulled open the door. She heard car doors slam. She grabbed her bag and Parker from the table. She wanted to run at full pelt away from the house,
but she knew it would be a mistake to leave the kitchen door open, so she pulled it closed and locked it. Hearing voices at the front of the house, she turned and ran across the lawn to a wooden shed with a grey felt roof. She hurriedly pulled on the parka and then squeezed between the shed and the hedge next to it, looking for a gap wide enough to get through. She heard more voices. At least two men had come to the back of the house. She pushed her bag through a gap in the hedge and then crawled through after it, stray twigs scratching across her face and catching in her hair. The garden she found herself in was a mirror image of the one behind her. She got to her feet and kept low as she ran over the grass, straightening up as she reached the house and taking a quick look behind her. There was no one following. She ran around the house and onto the street. She looked left and right, but the roads and pavements were clear, so she headed back towards Richmond Park. She felt safer in the park. The SUVs couldn't get to her, and she was fairly sure she could outrun any pursuers. She could go to ground in the park, call Hadley, and arrange to be collected there.